Arthur No. 22 was produced exclusively for the exhibition Nepotists, Opportunists, Friends, Freaks and Strangers Intersecting in the Grey Zone, an exhibition curated by Bolwerk, which takes place at Z33 in Hasselt, Belgium. The white or black box, thought of as grey or coloured and within a permanent change, this mentioned grey zone challenges traditional presentation venues. Radio Arthur takes advantage of this invitation and deploys experimental strategies that parallel those developed by Jean-François Lyotard for the exhibition Les Immatériaux at Centre Pompidou in Paris in the 1980s. The French philosopher Jean-François Lyotard, one of the main postmodern thinkers, adapted French post-structuralist thinking to the exhibition space by relating theoretical texts and audio recordings, technological inventions, literature, ethnological findings, and artistic works in a rhizomatic structure. Contributions by Franziska Gloser, Lucy Kolb, Mark Mutter, and Romy Rueker. The catalogue for Les Immatériaux was one of the most chaotic you are ever likely to see. Not bound, just loose paper sheets and pages are numbered, it might as well have been put together randomly. In this design, the catalogue also sought to reveal value through the now classic Cagean deconstructive trick of rendering all information equal in its delivery, the idea being that new or unusual readings of value could emerge as new patterns and relationships between things could be discerned. Given that it was printed in French, although bits have been translated by third parties, also lent the texts a certain obfuscating character. Don't forget that he who is speaking at this moment, and who in general designates himself by the word me then, who, as it happens, am speaking, am only going by drawing your attention to some points of petite politique and present history, to tell you a story, precisely, and unfold my little narrative. I urge you, as a preliminary instruction, not to wonder whether it is more or less true than another, but rather to consider that it exists, that it proceeds, weakly or strongly, I am no judge of that, from a storytelling potential which is almost invincible in everyone. Retelling Lyotard is not about breaking stories or being lost in the inside of details. It's a shift in thinking, a shift that sets your thinking in an outside as a working field of everyone's being. Within his concepts, discourse appears as a playground, heavy in its meaning, as it is not only reflection, but a mode of reality that develops human reality first of all. But human reality is limited, at the latest since machines were created in the likeness of man symbolically. The change technology brought was the great theme of Les Immatériaux, an exhibition Lyotard realised together with his co-curator Thierry Chaput in 1985 in the Centre Pompidou. I haven't seen the exhibition, so this story will be a collection of other stories and words cited, new spoken. Deliberate patchwork is a strategy which Lyotard would consider as still cubist, that is to say modern, because you can realise this strategy as an already known frame of form. With the decision to create an exhibition, Lyotard leaves his frame, language, and searches the field of arts, visual arts in their frame, to move closer to an artistic cognition. Consequently, he opposed all strategies of readability. The exhibition occupied the fifth floor of the Pompidou Centre, with its entrance foyer on the fourth floor mezzanine. The display apparatus included a large number of radio transmitters, each covering a carefully limited zone and each broadcasting a particular soundtrack. Visitors wore headphones. Musical messages, poems, prose, exclamations and quotations were transmitted as arts of time and the most immaterial form of communication. A broad range of topics was selected to form specific domains within the structure of the exhibition, from foodstuffs and painting to astrophysics and industry. These domains were grouped together according to the themes they illustrated. For instance, one of them looked at literary networks, and a computer writing experiment was designed to question the way in which computers dematerialize the handmade mark and potentially subvert the identity of authorship. Other early performative space experiments included Sound Space by Rolf Gehlhaar, in which interactive physical space was subverted and sound was manipulated, with nothing in the room being touched. In Les Immatériaux, he made the visitor realize that the existence of new materials, new technologies, computerized spaces, internet, would alter man's relationship with the world even more extremely. These new materials would force him to recognize that the old Cartesian program of mastering and possessing nature was history. These new materials were not, as Lyotard explained, materials that are new, but materials that work or talk themselves, and thus question the idea of man being the only one who works, talks, plans, and remembers. Goods, images, and signs themselves generate new processes, resulting in ever new goods, images, signs, and meanings. The sphere of influence of these processes extends far beyond the conscious intentions and interpretations of those who make and absorb it. This is the most fascinating proof of the ability of a work to work and to affect its own operations. It has a life of its own. That's what reality does. So does reality. Rolf Gehlhaar, a participant, reports, "Les Immatériaux was, I believe, being installed on the third floor of the Centre Pompidou. Lyotard's office was on the fifth floor, but you couldn't go directly from the third to the fifth. No, you had to take the lift to the basement, walk all the way to the other end of the building to change lifts, and then go to the fifth. There were only these two lifts, and about 100 people wanting to use them at any given time." The great man's office was large, light, airy, and strewn with the paraphernalia one commonly associates with great thinkers and curators. I told him of our problems. Not enough juice, not enough light, too much heat. He was friendly, affable even, but seemed to have difficulties in focusing on them. The thought briefly appeared to me that maybe he did not really understand what we were doing, and that perhaps even if he did understand, he didn't like the idea, that what I was doing was a bit too structural, too positive. I had already seen some of the other partially installed exhibits, and many of them seemed quite triste. Or was my only partial command of the French language insufficient to delve into the depths of this man's deeper thoughts? I also told him that I wanted to put some sort of graphic indications on the walls and the floor of the space, in order to make the control structure, i.e. the topographical distribution of the controls over the sounds, visible. I did not tell him that I also found the uninterrupted dark grey landscape of the space depressing. He had no objections and also assured me that we would get a proper electricity supply and that the lighting would also be attended to. As to the overheating, he said he was powerless to help me out. There is the material, that is to say, there is the reality, a story. The exhibition's title is a neologism. Les immatériaux, a transformation of the adjective immaterial, changed into a noun, male plural. What is it that this noun can designate? While writing this text, I became acutely conscious of Lyotard's notion of the sublime, a feeling of something overreaching our capacities of imagination, understanding, and expression. The feeling of the sublime is the sign of a différent that lies between the absolute that thought seeks to present and the greatest possible aesthetic magnitude that can be apprehended by the senses. If we follow Lyotard, thought must avoid trying to map, by analogy or other means, its feelings onto knowledge of objects. But it must also find a way to link feeling to the real, to the event. Art and literature name two of the places. There is a story, and every sentence is everything that is a sentence. Is not what is. And no more is real. One cannot say every sentence is real. Reality is a property of the referent to be established. It is not, including the reality of a sentence. Everything real is rational, yes, if rational signifies in conformity with the procedure of establishing the reality of a referent. In every sentence is, every sentence means everything that happens, tout ce qui arrive, is means there is, il y a, it happens, il arrive. But it happens is not what happens, in the sense that quod is not quid, that presentation is not situation. So is does not mean is there, and still less is real. Is signifies nothing. It would designate the occurrence before the signification, the content of the occurrence. Is would rather be arrive-t-il? Is it happening? Does it happen? Is it coming? Doesn't it sound like singing? And there he sings the sublime. The tragedy of life living us, not vice versa. Following Lyotard's figures out of logic, the split between the matériaux and the immatériaux cannot be understood or put into words, as one part is not human, in the sense that it is not absolutely intelligible. Maybe it can be grasped through the sublime as a feeling. Art is sublime where and when it strains to disclose the idea. It is sublime where its object is absent. From this point of view, theory, aesthetic theory, will have seemed to be the attempt by which the mind tries to rid itself of words, of the matter that they are, and finally of matter itself. Happily, this attempt has no chance of success. One cannot get rid of the thing. Always forgotten, it is unforgettable. In Human, page 143. Or human, as there was a challenge of time. And a challenge of time means a challenge of our time as well. History's time, every time. And that is, Lyotard says, the only way to think. And to think is to move time by starting to think elsewhere. In an interview, Bernard Blisten asked the French philosopher about his concepts concerning art. Bernard Blisten, but what can we say about the philosopher who decides that his job is to give us something to look at? Jean-François Lyotard, everybody knows that books are going through a period of crisis as instruments for the diffusion of ideas, and that this is a part of the general crisis of intellectual life today. Here, in what we could call a kind of democratic despotism that makes for the world we live in. And of course, there's no question of maintaining the superiority of any kind of aristocratic power. But both of us know very well that the philosopher experiences a very grave problem with respect to the writing or recording of what he has to say. And there is a problem of the shortcomings of the philosopher with respect to the available modes of writing and recording, or of what I would call inscription. As far as I myself am concerned, my acceptance of the idea, to use the words with which you've stated it, of becoming the philosopher who decides that his job is to give us something to look at, is something very simple and not even particularly original. I accept myself as a philosopher, and it seems to me to be important for the philosopher to be able to record what he thinks through the use of instruments that don't have to be restricted to the instruments of the book. It's just that simple. New and different things are at stake today, even though they're not totally new, and we have to try to understand the things that are being offered to us. It's as though one were now to decide to restrict one's interest in art to the question of the pleasure of the contemplation of the beautiful. Surely you'll agree that it's not that sort of thing that's most important and pertinent. It's as though we were to think about the romantic aesthetic of the sublime and then to back down from dealing with Duchamp. And I mention Duchamp because we know very well that his aesthetic had nothing to do with the sublime, that it leaves the sublime behind. And so today we have to ask ourselves what's now at stake in art. It's a question of limits, and one finds such questions everywhere, including the field of the sciences. And are the scientists still concerned with talking about the truth of the object? Everything is different now that the Anglo-Saxon epistemologists have begun to stress the idea of non-falsification. Like philosophers in general, these people are now interested in questioning the transitional finalities of the work they do. And that has always been the distinguishing trait of philosophy, which is to say that philosophy has always investigated the rules of the field of philosophical thought and never been able to define them. Bernard Blisten, could we say that you're attempting to establish a relationship between scientific and artistic modes of thought? Jean-François Lyotard, undoubtedly, the idea of artistic creation is a notion that comes from the aesthetics of Romanticism, the aesthetics of the idea of genius. And I'm sure you'll agree that the idea of the artist as creator is, to say the least, of strictly limited utility in our world today. That's no longer where we really are. We're no longer concerned with the philosophy of subjective genius and all the aura that goes along with it. With Duchamp, we already find ourselves in an area that has an aspect of bricolage. There's that side where you think of him as an inventeur du temps gratuit. Bernard Blisten, but wouldn't you still think of the work of Duchamp as something relative rather than some kind of transhistorical value? Jean-François Lyotard, well, really both yes and no, since that's the way it always is with art. It always has a value as an expression of its time, but there's also a way in which it can always be perceived as lying outside of the time that produced it. There's always something that turns art into a transhistorical truth, and that's the part of the art that I think of as philosophical. It's within this part of art that it poses the question of what it has at stake. Art, after all, is a relatively modern notion. Even Greek tragedy couldn't have been said to be art for the Greeks. It was still something else, and it's clear that we have to wait at least until the close of the Middle Ages to discover the emergence of an art that isn't simply an expression, for instance, of metaphysics or religion or political praise. What strikes me, if we can start out from Duchamp, is the way it can seem, from a certain point of view, to be difficult to be an artist if one isn't a philosopher as well. I don't mean that the artist will have to read Plato or Aristotle. I mean that he has to posit the question of what he has at stake. He has to ask himself about the nature of what he's involved in doing. Precisely this question is the most interesting thing to be found in the works of art that are strongest today. It's the thing in which these works are most interested. What's at stake is something that's extraordinarily serious, and it's not at all a question of pleasure, and not even of the way the pleasure of the sublime is intermixed with pain. It's a question instead of a relationship to time and space and sensibility, even though I don't like to make use of that word. What I mean to say is that certain works have a structure that keeps them from being concerned with their existence as events. They do something entirely different as an attentive observer comes away with the feeling that their engagement with the senses, if any such engagement exists at all, is of far less importance than a primary interest in the most fundamental philosophical question of all. Why does something happen rather than nothing?
Ja, also, das ist schon mal einig gewesen.
both.
Stereo, un discours d'amour. Lyotard talking to Brecht. In the following radio play by Romy Rüecker, we will hear an intimate conversation between Jean-François Lyotard and Bert Brecht. Romy Rüecker used two recordings, a lecture by Lyotard from 1994 and a radio show by Bertolt Brecht from 1952, cut together in negative editing. This new conversation is based on those parts of spoken language which are commonly cut out in radio shows because they might disturb the listener's comprehension and seem to have no informational content. Voice that does not sing, language that does not speak. Marc Matter, member of the artist group Institut für Feinmotorik, produced a sound collage entitled Voiceover, in which recordings of human voices and sounds taken from records containing sound poetry and artistic voice acrobatics are used. The source material consists of all kinds of sounds that the human voice apparatus, mouth, lips, tongue, throat, teeth, nose, etc., is able to generate. Some of the original recordings have already been manipulated with sound effects in their original versions. Echo and delay, distortion, speed and pitch shifting, tape splicing and cut-ups, even electronic or digital processing have been used in the original compositions. These voice sounds are neither language nor singing, they do not contain semantic sense and meaning, and are not intended to be musical chants in a conventional way. It's something different that emerges here, something abstract but purely vital, some kind of grey area of human communication. Breathing and guttering, humming and stuttering, smacking and harumphs are the vocabulary with which an abstract radio play has been put together. Some of the used sound pieces come close to a spoken word or a musical chanting, though. At this point, it is important to remember the development of contemporary music in the 20th century to be a result of the avant-garde movements which pushed the limits of music to noise, Geräusch and silence. Similar developments happened in literature at the end of the 19th century. Poets such as Paul Scherbart or Christian Morgenstern undermined the communicative aspect of language in an artistic way, using nonsense lyrics, fantasy language, and the bare lexical sign, including special characters and signs, pushing the limits to pure visual poetry. With the beginning of the 20th century, the destruction of sense became more radical and absolute. Futurism and Dadaism disburdened language from semantic meaning and traditional communicative functions, inventing their famous sound poems. This tradition continued after World War II and emerged, influenced from the experimental language games of the letterists and the use of modern recording and studio technique, such as high-density microphones, tape recorders and sound manipulation, into contemporary sound poetry, or poésie sonore, how the French sound poet, theorist and publisher Henri Chopin called it. Since the late 1950s, the classical music avant-garde have also discovered voice experiments and free-of-sense vocal acrobatics, sometimes directly influenced and in some cases with the participation of some protagonists of the poésie sonore scene. By the time Roland Barthes drivelled about Le Grain de la Voix, a broad and vital scene of sound poets had already evolved. They came from experimental literature, contemporary fine art and avant-garde music, liberating language from semantic duties and setting free the bare human voice, often making use of sound recording and studio technique to enhance the compositions of human voice sounds. Listen now to a dense mix of some selected pieces of sound poetry, poésie sonore, experimental voice pieces and vocal-based avant-garde music, an asemantic rain of vocal oddities, an abstract radio play lacking sense and reason. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Okay.
Das ist ein lauter Jingle, das ist nicht wirklich ein Jingle.
Es geht gleich weiter.
Sollen wir einfach mal kommen, wir spielen?
Wir können aber noch nicht.
Wir können noch nicht.
Achso,
doch. Komm, wir spielen noch einmal.
Ja.
In Drama as Discourse, Lucy Kolb attempts to relate aesthetic methods developed by Bert Brecht for his epic drama, together with Jean-François Lyotard's concept of the sublime as an aesthetic existential. Using examples from contemporary art, including Johanna Billing and Goshka Machuga, aesthetic methods should be elaborated that parallel both Brecht and Lyotard.
There was once a wealthy collector of exotic birds in Italy in the 16th century, who commissioned merchant ships to bring back specimens from south of the equator. By the time the birds arrived in Europe, though, the legs, being made of more delicate biological matter than the plumage, had perished and fallen off. As the suppliers of the birds never actually explained this to the collector, a theory proliferated for some time thereafter that birds of paradise simply didn't have legs and flew for the duration of their lives, while stouter-billed birds drilled their beaks into the trunks of trees to take a rest. Such is the folly of deductive logic. Of course, what we now claim as knowledge might also arrive at through similarly erroneous deductions from incomplete information. Current theories on antimatter, or even the health benefits of vegetables, might turn out to be as fallacious as a flat earth. But once something is known, it is assimilated culturally and historiographically, and parceled within our own personal narratives to become a calcified matter of fact or a solipsistic nugget. This is then handed around like a coin and implicated in a system of cultural exchange until it is eventually assigned a specific culturally determined position. This is how we build castles of understanding on the shiftest of sands.
This is a quote by Sally O'Reilly from her introduction text in the exhibition catalogue Sleep of Uro by Goshka Machuga from 2007. Such castles that I'm interested in are those of the fable and history itself. How does playwright Bertolt Brecht approach them in his theoretical text on theater, Kleines Organon für das Theater from 1949, and how does the philosopher Jean-François Lyotard subsume them in one of his lectures from the 1990s on postmodern fable? Based on Machuga's artistic practice, I want to outline a narrative that it inscribes itself neither in the canon of the grand narrative nor in the micro-narrative of its collapse. It is about describing a field in which the hope of identifying knowledge has been abandoned and yielded to the joy of revealing, connecting and expanding. Possibly the journey of the fables of knowledge I am outlining here parallels the fable of the exotic birds. They have become culturally and historiographically assimilated and part of my personal narrative. The philosopher Lyotard deals with the notion of the fable by assigning it to the category of postmodernism. Thereby he focuses on the interest of interpretations and connections and extensions, rather than on the aspiration for identifying knowledge. The theoretical texts on theater by playwright Brecht are, among other things, instructions, comments, or processes of criticism. At large, Brecht describes techniques, that is, aesthetic methods, that build the basis of his plays. Now we'll listen to Lyotard, an excerpt of a lecture named Une fable postmoderne. The lecture was part of a series of lectures organized by the Zeta d'Écran in Zurich in the 1990s.
Donc le réalisme accepte et je dirais même exige la présence en lui de l'imaginaire. Il exige que ce dernier, bien loin d'être étranger à la réalité, en soit un état. L'imaginaire, c'est la réalité à l'état naissant. La science et la technique elles-mêmes ne fabulent pas moins et ne sont pas moins poétiques que la peinture, la littérature ou le cinéma. La seule différence entre les uns et les autres tient à la contrainte de vérification ou falsification de l'hypothèse. La fable est une hypothèse qui se soustrait à cette contrainte de vérification.
In analogy to O'Reilly, who reminds us of the fictional part in every passed down knowledge in her introduction, based on the artistic practice of Machuga, Lyotard characterizes knowledge itself as a fable. Realism and the imaginary constitute no contradiction for Lyotard. He perceives the imaginary not as a renouncing of reality, but states that every realism demands imagination. In the imaginary, Lyotard sees the reality in the state of its birth. In that sense, science is not less poetic than art, and therefore art and science are not categorically different. Both science and art romance and create fictions. The only difference is that the hypothesis of science must necessarily be verified or falsified. The fable, on the other hand, is a hypothesis which awaits that need. Machuga confronts the viewer with tales of disbelief, with a dual relationship with the content of her work. On the other hand, it invites them into an awareness of the historical distance that separates us from certain beliefs and cultural attitudes, and on the other, it demonstrates its enduring charm as a contemporary response to the need for the irrational. By using strategies that parallel those developed by Brecht, Machuga shifts the roles of both the protagonist and the viewer of a play or an artistic work into the role of an observer. The observer is asked to develop a position towards the work. Another relation between Machuga and Brecht is that their approach depends on a constant oscillation between empathy and alienation. It sets both opacity and transparency in dialogue. In the catalogue, O'Reilly explains Machuga's approach by quoting Marxist biologist J.B.S. Holden, who describes four states in the process towards the acceptance of scientific theories as follows.
First stage. This is worthless nonsense. Second stage. It is an interesting but perverse point of view. Third stage. This is true but quite unimportant. Fourth stage. I have always said so.
Brecht might have liked this, as he probably added purposely titled positions and fluctuations to his theoretical platforms. Driven by a general skepticism, he added meaningful gaps and uncertainties to unite his readable, half-readable and barely readable writings. His theoretical texts embody the sketchy and modifiable quality they ask for in themselves. It is them that preserve the core of the fable. By preserving the fundamentals of classical drama in the fable, Brecht keeps up the Aristotelic tradition in a sort of last-minute rescue. The fable, in a sense of a fiction, offers a totality and an equivalent to the conception of a notion, a knowledge, a truth. Brecht's deconstruction of the classical drama turns into the conservation in the shape of the epic theater. Machuga uses the fable too, and thereby transports notions, knowledges, and truths by providing scissors for the journey of those notions, knowledges, truths who are transported. They are empowered to cut themselves off at any moment. For every format, whether artistic work, theoretical text, or film program, Machuga develops an individual form of translation from the exhibition space into the catalogue. The translation again reflects the role and function of the works within the exhibition. The individual contributions for the catalogue, among others, theoretical texts, poetry, sheet music, exhibition views, film program, form within their interplay a drama that requires a precise choreography of the individual elements. The different elements, that is, the epic intervention, comment one another. The music doesn't accentuate the play, the set design doesn't illustrate the music, etc. With the epic, the narrative, Brecht translates a print medium, the epic was successful at that time, especially in the print medium, into the theater medium. The translation becomes possible through technical innovations such as projections, motorization of the stage and film. In this context, O'Reilly connects the fashionable desire of the 18th century to collect exotica from the New World with the intuitive and creative leaps of scientific thinking and technological innovation.
Through Sleep of Ulro, Machuga has neither created a grand narrative nor pursued some axiomatic belief, but rather allowed the materiality of history a freer rein that it might ordinarily enjoy. Thierry de Duve identifies the underlying characteristics of 20th century art in his book Kant after Duchamp. I quote, "At the intersection of magical action and scientific knowledge, artistic making attributes a symbolic power to the things it names." Quote end. Art, like alchemy, adds a flash of magic to a dash of pragmatics in order to transcend the quotidian to the very material of the everyday. Sleep of Ulro is a cabinet of curiosity in which the hope of identifying hard and fast knowledge has been abandoned to the joy of revealing, connecting and extending.
In order to successfully build castles of understanding on the shiftiest of sands, the awareness of the economic relations is certainly helpful, as one could argue with Brecht. Machuga's works show parallels to Brecht's aesthetic methods. In Sleep of Ulro, she develops the same knowledge of social and economic circumstances of the work that Brecht demanded from its actors. Machuga also uses some sort of Brechtian historization to escape a postmodern free-for-all approach to subject matter, imagery, medium and methodologies. With the technique of historization in production and play, Brecht relates the work to a specific historical moment, a moment that he shows in his work at the same time as a sketch and a possibility. Historization in Brecht's understanding leads to a division of the audience in the sense of making it impossible for the viewer to identify with the work. Corresponding to that method, Machuga shows a variety of items that use the style of German Expressionism, botanical drawings, spiritualism, and Soviet constructivism to show the intellects, dreams, fears, hopes, and failures of the others. The question, who controls the meaning of things, is not to be answered. It becomes contestable as to who exactly controls the meaning of the items in this particular context, the appropriator, the appropriated, or us, the interpreters. Now we'll listen to another excerpt of Lyotard's lecture named Une fable postmoderne.
Or la fable que nous avons entendue est certes un récit, mais l'histoire qu'elle raconte n'offre aucun des principaux traits de l'historicité. D'abord, c'est une histoire physique, si je peux dire. Elle ne concerne que l'énergie et la matière comme état de l'énergie. L'homme y est tenu pour un système matériel complexe, la conscience pour un effet de langage, et le langage pour un système matériel très complexe, symbolique. Ensuite, le temps qui est mis en jeu dans cette histoire n'est qu'une diachronie banale. La succession est découpée en unités d'horloge arbitrairement définies à partir de mouvements physiques supposés uniformes et réguliers. Ce temps-là n'est pas une temporalité de conscience qui exige que le passé et le futur, dans leur absence même, soient néanmoins présents ou tenus présents en même temps que le présent. La fable n'admet une telle temporalité qu'à l'intérieur de systèmes dotés du langage symbolique, car celui-ci permet en effet la mémorisation et l'attente, c'est-à-dire la présence du passé et du futur.
In the so-called physical history that Lyotard refers to here, man is a complex material system. Human consciousness is perceived as an effect of language. Language then is a tremendously complex and symbolic system. The aspect of time in this history is a banal diachrony, a linear consecutiveness. The sequence is organized in unities of time and defined arbitrarily by steady physical movement. As Lyotard points out, this perception of time has nothing to do with the temporality of consciousness. In its presence, past and future are absently present. The fable, as Lyotard understands it, allows history such a temporality. The fable allows the simultaneity of memory, what was, and the conception of what can be. Growing up in the reach of the Soviet Union, where history was presented as a rigid narrative, Machuga has turned away from such absolutism. Machuga attempts to expand the necessarily reductive processes of science. In collecting displaying items, she reflects on the meaning that is generated in this process. In this way, her work, in the spirit of Brecht and Lyotard, reveals the fable parts of the scientific narrative. The sketched-out aesthetic methods developed by Brecht are also opening up a formerly closed system. In that sense, they are not clearly categorizable as modern or postmodern. This is why these thoughts, formulated in 1950, are currently of interest again. They operate in an intersection, which is what I try to show in Machuga's work.
Sleep of Ulro, page 163. Film program, selected by Olivia Plender. First film, Curse of the Demon and Night of the Demon, a double feature. Certificate not rated. Directed by Jacques Tourneur, English, 1957. Running time, 178 minutes.
It has been written since the beginning of time, even unto these ancient stones, that evil, supernatural creatures exist in a world of darkness. And it is also said, man using the magic power of the ancient runic symbols can call forth these powers of darkness, the demons of hell. Through the ages, men have feared and worshipped these creatures. The practice of witchcraft, the cults of evil, have endured and exist to this day. We'll be right back.
Second film, Deus e o Diabo na Terra do Sol. Certificate not rated. Directed by Glauber Rocha. Portuguese with English subtitles. 1964. Running time, 125 minutes. Third film, The Magician. Certificate, Parental Guidance. Directed by Ingmar Bergman. Swedish with English subtitles, 1958. Running time, 97 minutes. Fourth film, The Amazing Mr. X. Certificate not rated. Directed by Bernard Vorhaus. English, 1948. Running time, 78 minutes. Fifth film, The Devil Rides Out. Certificate 16. Directed by Terence Fisher. English, 1968. Running time, 94 minutes. Sixth film, The Holy Mountain, certificate not rated, directed by Alejandro Jodorowsky. English, 1973. Running time, 114 minutes.
Thank you.
seventh film, The Medium. Certificate not rated. Directed by Pierre Morin. English, 1977. Running time, 59 minutes. Eighth film, H. E. Wells' The Time Machine. Certificate, Parental Guidance. Directed by George Pell. English, 1960. Running time, 99 minutes. Ninth film, Suspiria, Certificate 18, directed by Dario Argento, English 1977, running time 94 minutes.
Susie Banyan decided to perfect her ballet studies in the most famous school of dance in Europe. She chose the celebrated Academy of Fribourg. One day at 9 a.m, she left Kennedy Airport, New York, and arrived in Germany at 10:40 p.m. local time.
Tenth film, The Wizard of Oz, certificate, Universal, directed by Victor Fleming, English, 1939, running time, 98 minutes. Eleventh film, Audit, certificate 12, directed by Carl Theodor Dreyer, Danish with English subtitles, 1955, running time 119 minutes.